Since the 1980s, there had been a self-reinforcing cycle in the opium belt. War created desperation, which made opium attractive for poor farmers, which created profits for warlords, who then used those resources to fight for greater wealth and power, which created more desperation for poor farmers. Britain had agreed to become the lead nation on narcotics policy after 2002, because Afghan heroin was sold on British streets, and Prime Minister Tony Blair was personally enthusiastic about the drug's portfolio. British and Australian special forces formed a clandestine paramilitary force, Task Force 333, to raid labs in Helmand and Kandahar, and to mentor Afghan special police. Yet British development specialists opposed militarized poppy eradication and aerial spraying. They thought it was counterproductive, unfair, and unsustainable, a view shared in much of the British military, whose generals concluded they had enough of a fight on their hands in Helmand without aggravating farmers and itinerant laborers. The British developed an integrated policy emphasizing public education, demand reduction, and the development of alternative livelihoods for farmers that might compete with the allure of poppy prices. The approach made sense on paper, but it was obvious by 2006 that it was having little to no impact on crop production. Britain's Foreign Office also allocated tens of millions of dollars to pay Afghan farmers to eradicate their own poppy fields. The money yielded corruption, agricultural market distortions, and confusion. Career MI6 officers assigned to work on Afghanistan, who were drawn into these anti-drug schemes, concluded that the British narcotics brief was a waste of time and effort. The CIA had been blinded to Afghanistan's political deterioration and the Taliban's revival by the distractions of Iraq and the agency's relentless, narrow focus on Al-Qaeda, these British officers felt. But they were willing to concede that MI6 had been similarly blinded by opium. Faisullah Kakar, Afghanistan's Deputy Minister of Public Health, was the member of Karzai's cabinet best qualified to evaluate the risks that might be posed to the Afghan people by aerial spraying. He had grown up in Kabul, but earned a bachelor's degree in biology from Earlham College in Indiana, a master's degree in toxicology from Indiana University, and a doctoral degree in epidemiology from the University of Washington. He had later worked for the World Health Organization in Pakistan. Kakar understood that glyphosate, the main ingredient in Roundup, was widely used by American gardeners and farmers, who poured about 100 million pounds of the stuff on their lawns and fields every year. The Environmental Protection Agency judged that glyphosate had low toxicity for humans, slight toxicity for birds, and was harmless for fish and bees. Apart from requiring a warning label, the EPA did not restrict the chemical giant Monsanto from manufacturing or selling Roundup to Americans. Yet Kakar seriously doubted that it made sense to douse Afghan fields with the stuff. "You are telling us about how safe it is," he told Doug Wankel, the DEA official in the Kabul embassy. "Remember DDT?" He was referring to dichlorodiphenyltrichloroethane, a synthetic insecticide developed in the 1940s. Initially popular and believed to be safe, DDT turned out to be highly persistent in the environment and was ultimately classified by the EPA as a probable human carcinogen. Kakar pointed out that Afghanistan had a much more agricultural economy than the United States, that runoff from fields went straight to local water supplies, and that many Afghans were totally dependent on farming. The country could not afford a massive spraying campaign based on current scientific assessments, only to discover later that glyphosate was not as safe as advertised. Kakar propounded his views before Karzai and the full Afghan cabinet. He said that while the Americans used thousands of pounds of the same spray safely in California, the United States did much better at protecting its water sources, whereas Afghans drink from open water courses. "This is the most popular chemical in the world," Bill Wood pointed out. Yet Wood and other advocates for spraying underestimated the asymmetries of power in these arguments with Afghans. Most Afghan decision-makers, and for that matter, many Colombians, were not in a position to independently judge the long-term public health risks of glyphosate. And why should they accept EPA judgments as gospel, given America's own history of regulatory failures involving chemicals and public health? Amrullah Saleh and other cabinet ministers objected to the spraying plan on the grounds that Taliban propaganda would profit greatly from any spraying. Karzai's instinctive sense was that if farmers and itinerant poppy pickers in Helmand and Kandahar looked up and saw American helicopters thundering over the horizon as dusters poured chemicals onto their fields, they would recall the atrocities of Soviet aerial warfare and blame Hamid Karzai. Gradually during 2007, while remaining cautious about offending President Bush, but with the unified support of his cabinet, Karzai made his position clear to the Americans. He opposed aerial spraying. He also opposed any role for the U.S. military in fighting drug production. Karzai battled within his cabinet to impose his view. In September 2007, Vice President Ahmad Zia Massoud, a brother of the late guerrilla leader, published an opinion piece in Britain's Telegraph newspaper arguing in favor of aerial spraying. Karzai blew up at him at a cabinet meeting the next day, by Massoud's account. "You wrote on your own will, or did the foreigners tell you to write it?" "I don't have any contact with any foreigners, but I know you do," Massoud answered. "Oh, brother, those years have long gone in which you could print out your own money and do and say whatever you want," Karzai said, referring to the years of the early 1990s when Massoud's brother was Kabul's leading power. "Mr. President, we all know the foreigners brought you to Uruzgan in U.S. helicopters." "If you want to resign, you can resign right now," Karzai said. The problem was, for the advocates of Plan Colombia and the Bush administration, without aerial spraying in Helmand and Kandahar, there was no realistic path to reduce opium production enough to hurt the Taliban. The State Department contracted with DynCorp, a private security firm, to train Afghan forces to eradicate poppy fields one by one on the ground. Taliban and armed drug gangs attacked the Afghan forces. Without the efficiencies of aerial spraying, all the ground eradication programs combined never eliminated more than 10% of the national poppy crop. "Ground eradication will never work," the DEA's Mike Braun argued. "You're going to have to hit it hard from the air." The British encouraged and supported Karzai's conclusion that aerial spraying was dangerous. Schweik raised the possibility that the United States could spray in Helmand and Kandahar even without Karzai's direct permission. His opponents in Washington replied with classified memos arguing that if the United States proceeded on its own, you would be conducting chemical warfare in violation of international law. The fights dragged on for so long because everyone involved on the American side knew that President Bush had a conviction about spraying. He mentioned the issue to almost everyone who visited him to talk about Afghanistan. Yet he could not make it happen. Bush would not act without Karzai's approval, and certainly not if it meant risking press leaks that he was ignoring chemical weapons treaties. And because neither the Pentagon nor the CIA agreed that aerial spraying was wise, the two American security agencies with the greatest leverage over Karzai made little effort to change his mind. The prolonged stalemate over Plan Afghanistan during 2007 wasted American money and effort. It also opened a breach of trust between Hamid Karzai and the United States. An early episode of mutual suspicion in what would soon become a cascade. Understandably, Karzai was losing faith in the conception and conduct of American and British policy in the Taliban heartland. He had long harbored suspicions that the British favored Pakistan over Afghanistan, at the expense of his government's authority. Implausible and even outrageous as it might sound to American officials, Karzai was open to the theory, whispered to him by some of his palace advisors, that the Americans and British might be working a secret plan to bring the Taliban back in southern Afghanistan in concert with Pakistan. He remained irritated that the British and Americans had forced him to remove Sher Mohammed Akhundzada as Helmand's governor on the grounds that he profited from the opium economy. The question is, why do we have Taliban controlling those areas now, when 2 years ago I had control of Helmand? Karzai asked State Department visitors. When Sher Mohammed was governor there, we had girls in schools and only 160 foreign troops. The international community pushed me to remove him, and now look where we are. My question is, do you want a bad guy on your side or working for the Taliban? When Afghans are in charge, drugs are less, but where the international community is in charge, drugs are up. The suspicion flowed both ways. In 2006, Newsweek published stories naming Karzai's half-brother, Ahmed Wali, based in Kandahar, as a narcotics trafficker. Karzai asked both U.S. and British intelligence whether they had any evidence to back that up. But Washington and London admitted that they had only numerous rumors and allegations, not the kind of evidence to support a criminal indictment. Karzai fumed and threatened libel actions. But to Schweik and other enthusiasts of aerial spraying, it was hard to ignore the hypothesis that Karzai might be protecting Ahmed Wali and other political allies profiting from opium, particularly in the South, Karzai's political base. Even though the debate about drugs and the Taliban was never resolved, the planned Columbia model created a rationale for one of the most significant American military pivots of the war. The decision during 2008 and 2009 to send thousands of U.S. Marines to Helmand, the heartland of the poppy economy, despite the province's small population and isolated geography. There remained those at the DEA and the White House who believed fervently that if Karzai had permitted aerial spraying, it would have weakened the Taliban profoundly. Those who doubted Plan Afghanistan broadened their examinations of Taliban finance. Only after the production of new intelligence studies did the evidence become clearer, at least to some decision-makers at the White House, that Afghanistan's opium economy is so decentralized that while the Taliban did indeed access funds, as a National Security Council official involved put it, there certainly would be a Taliban insurgency without drugs. The drug policy argument became the latest, if only, thread of the classified Afghan war debate in Washington as the Bush administration expired. If only the Taliban did not make money from opium. If only the Pakistan sanctuary could be eliminated. If only reconstruction aid would deliver a credible alternative to the Taliban's coercive politics. In any event, for all the budget allocated, for all the fields burned and labs raided, Plan Afghanistan achieved little before it was largely aborted during the Obama administration. In 2007, the value of Afghan opium cultivation at the farm gate was one of the largest ever, according to the United Nations. The area under poppy reached a new record at 476,000 acres. In the years to come, the Afghan opium economy would fluctuate, but ultimately reach new records still. Chapter 16. Murder and the Deep State. By 2007, Dave Smith, the retired colonel deployed by the Defense Intelligence Agency, had moved to the Pentagon's policy office to work on Pakistan. Part of his job still included staying in touch with his network of friends in the Pakistan Army and ISI to listen in private to their assessments. That spring, he sought out his old command and staff college friend, Mahmoud Ahmed, the former ISI director fired by Musharraf, in October 2001. He now lived in Lahore, the tattered but entrancing former Mughal city in the heart of Punjab, near the border with India. The previous summer, General Mahmoud had spent a month or so with friends in the Tablighi, or the proselytizing group, a worldwide network of Deobandi Muslims devoted to deepening the faith of Sunnis. At ISI, Mahmoud had worn aviator glasses and kept a brush mustache. Now he wore a trim white beard. He padded around his comfortable home in a salwar kameez. Analysts at the U.S. Embassy had told Smith that he would find his friend changed by faith, but Smith found him to be much the same. He arrived at Mahmoud's house on May 27, 2007. Pakistan was sinking into crisis, shaken by the very radicals the general had once protected. Encouraged by Al-Qaeda, Islamist groups long nurtured by ISI had turned on the Pakistani state. They mounted dozens of suicide bombings that would take more than 600 Pakistani lives that year. In the capital, armed revolutionaries had barricaded themselves inside the Lal Masjid, or Red Mosque, from which they threatened the government and carried out vigilante assaults to enforce religious morals. Plainly, Pervez Musharraf had lost his grip on power after 8 years in office. In March, he had rashly fired the Chief Justice of Pakistan's Supreme Court, touching off a mass revolt known as the Lawyers' Movement. He was under pressure from both liberals and Islamists. The old friends settled in Mahmoud's living room and took tea. Lahore was a bastion of the Lawyers' Movement. "He has shot himself in the foot, the ankle, the leg, the knee, and the thigh. And all of it unnecessarily," Mahmoud said of Musharraf. Musharraf had held the high ground when he first seized power, but had made one political mistake after another, Mahmoud continued. Holding a phony referendum on his rule made him look like a tin-pot dictator. And then he had built a political party run by traditional thuggish Poles who belied his promises of modernization. The question now was whether Musharraf would resign from the army and try to run for president again as a civilian, or whether he would do something rash, such as to impose a national state of emergency to remain a dictator. Musharraf was afraid of anything that threatened his grip on power, Mahmoud went on, and would do anything to retain it. He will keep his uniform on, because it is his source of power, and he will use the ISI to manipulate the outcome of the next election if he thinks it's necessary. He spoke about that with an insider's confidence. They talked at length about religion. If Islam was truth, then a messy state like Pakistan was a flawed vessel for its revelations. "Splits in Islam have always been caused by politics and politicians," Mahmoud said. "Musharraf has no standing to advocate for enlightened moderation in Islam because he is not a moral man, and the people know it. About the prospects for security in Pakistan and Afghanistan, and for the success of American ambitions, he remained doubtful. Religious extremism is spreading," he said. "Military force won't work. Military force won't work in Afghanistan either," he continued. "If the intent is to stabilize Afghanistan, the Taliban were and are the best solution." "What is the solution?" Smith asked him. It was clear that the Taliban was not an answer acceptable to the United States. "Withdraw your legions," Mahmoud answered with a smile, quoting a line from the movie Ben-Hur. "The U.S. military campaign is not working. You're creating more enemies than you're killing. You don't need a large military force to go after Al-Qaeda. And what is Al-Qaeda these days, anyway? It's more of an idea than a force in being." Smith took his leave and pledged to stay in touch. He wrote up his notes for the Pentagon's leadership. Mahmoud's arguments would read to some there like the same ISI talking points the United States had endured for a decade or more. In time, it would become clear that the general's views of the American military campaign in Afghanistan, if irritating to hear, had a basis in fact. That spring, however, withdrawal was not a recommendation Secretary of Defense Robert Gates or his Central Command uniformed leadership was in a mood to consider. Their instinct shared at the CIA's highest levels and among many of the agency's operators on the front lines in South Asia, was something like the opposite. The United States had not yet applied enough military force to quell al-Qaeda and the Taliban. Benazir Bhutto, the glamorous Harvard and Oxford-educated daughter of an executed former Pakistani prime minister, had served two terms as prime minister, between 1988 and 1990, and again between 1993 and 1996, before she was forced into exile in Dubai, pressured by corruption investigations focused on her family, particularly her husband, Asif Zardari, a rakish businessman who played polo and had bought a multi-million dollar estate in England. Between her glaring sense of entitlement and a tireless use of the media, Benazir Bhutto could seem like a machine that operates solely in the mode of victimization, as her estranged niece Fatima Bhutto put it. Yet she remained in 2007 a symbol of reform in Pakistan and had generally liberal political impulses, in Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice's judgment. If the big idea shaping American policy toward Afghanistan in 2007 was Planned Columbia, in Pakistan, it was the effort to bring Benazir Bhutto back home to share power with Musharraf. Quietly but persistently, the State Department and the British Foreign Office worked to broker a deal between the two liberal leaders. Rice was aware that power-sharing arrangements are difficult to carry out because, in general, the parties don't really want to share power. Bhutto and Musharraf both tended to see themselves as indispensable saviors of Pakistan, a role that was inherently difficult to share. Yet Rice and her British counterparts hoped, nonetheless, that a deal might unite the country's liberal-minded forces against violent Islamists. Ashfaq Kayani, Musharraf's enigmatic protege, now the Director General of ISI, led an initial round of discussions. In January 2007, Bhutto flew by helicopter to a palace in Abu Dhabi to meet secretly with Musharraf. To her surprise, the meeting was long and friendly. They exchanged cell phone numbers, talked periodically afterward, and met again privately in July. By then, Bhutto had decided that she could return home and re-enter politics, even though her negotiations with Musharraf were incomplete. In September, on the eve of her journey back to Pakistan, Bhutto met an American journalist in the lounge of the Ritz-Carlton Hotel in Washington. She had invited reporters to join her when she flew from exile into Karachi. She sat at a table near a jazz pianist. Her husband dropped by at one point, wearing a leisure suit and a gold chain and carrying shopping bags. Bhutto was 54, with pale and youthful skin. She was in a giddy mood. She had the ability, honed when she was president of the Oxford Union, to transform informal conversation into oratory, a feat that made her seem at once impressive and untrustworthy. She spoke with particular conviction about the need to curtail Pakistan's intelligence services. "The security apparatus must be reformed," she said. "Unless that is done, it is going to be very difficult for us to dismantle the terrorist networks and the militant networks. And today, they're a threat not only to other countries, but to the unity and survival of Pakistan." She added that she wanted to bring the tribal areas into the modern world, the 21st century. "The people there do not have fundamental human rights." This was vintage Bhutto. Perfect pitch liberalism and, at the same time, a formulation barely distinguishable from the American foreign policy of the moment. The exception to her accommodation of the Bush administration's agenda lay in her jaundiced attitude toward the Army and the ISI, institutions to which the administration had given more than $10 billion in financial aid. "General Musharraf's team has relied on the principle that to catch a thief, you send a thief," she said, speaking of the peace deals he had forged with militants in North and South Waziristan. "They've said, these are reformed Taliban or reformed militants, and let's use them. It hasn't worked. And we must really pause and think, where do they get their food from, after all? to feed and look after irregular armies that have thousands of people, and to clothe them, and to heal their wounds when they get wounded in battle. It requires a huge apparatus. So it requires a real breakdown in governance for such forces to continue to prosper and grow. That's what we're seeing in Pakistan, a breakdown in governance. That was, in some respects, the Bush administration's hypothesis as well. Its policy remained to train and equip Pakistani security forces and to provide extensive development aid. In the summer of 2007, the U.S. Embassy in Islamabad produced a PowerPoint deck, Strategy for Pakistan's Federally Administered Tribal Areas, that summarized the latest plan to fix the country. Its strategic objective was to permanently render FATA inhospitable to terrorists and extremists. This would be accomplished by enhancing the legitimacy and writ of the Pakistan government, improving economic, security, and social conditions, and supporting permanent, sustainable change. These were buzzwords, but at least the clichés came with a well-funded 5-year budget. In the tribal areas alone, where only a few million people lived scattered across a vast area, the Bush administration planned to spend $100 million a year on jobs, health services, water supply, and other development. It would add an average of about $25 million a year on road construction to connect the region to the heartland of Pakistan, and tens of millions more annually on the Frontier Corps, special ops, intelligence, and advanced training. The tribal areas will not be transformed overnight, the embassy plan conceded, but there are few missions more critical to U.S. national security or more deserving of our considered patience. Force is a necessary component of an overall strategy, but not sufficient alone. The Bush administration placed a major bet during 2007 on the Frontier Corps, the locally raised paramilitary force. Its officers and soldiers were Pashtuns. They sometimes balked at assaulting fellow Pashtuns among the Taliban. The Pakistani Taliban and Al-Qaeda exploited their weakness and recruited traitors. Compromised Frontier Corps soldiers faced court-martial proceedings and imprisonment in trials the Musharraf government never publicized. Mullahs in the tribal areas refused to preside over proper burials for fallen soldiers because the dead fought a mercenary campaign for Washington and did not perish righteously. "We know that you have become America's slave and are serving infidel Musharraf and have become a traitor to your religion for food, clothes, and shelter," pamphlets tacked up on walls in North Waziristan warned. A soldier in a Frontier Corps uniform shot dead an American Army officer as he departed a border flag meeting that spring. The assassination was most unfortunate, the Pakistan Army Vice Chief Ahsan Hayat told a State Department official. Pakistan, he said, had investigated the assailant's personal history, family, and the state of the Frontier Corps generally, and remained convinced the incident was the result of an individual disgruntled soldier, not part of any kind of trend or broader problem. Neither Musharraf nor the Punjabi-dominated regular army leadership wanted to mount an invasion of the tribal areas with regular Pakistan army forces, since that might only provoke more revenge-seeking suicide bombings and violence in the Pakistani heartland. Musharraf's sense was that to have any chance of success in the tribal areas, the army needed at least one political ally among Waziristan's major tribal groupings. The Mesuds, from their stronghold in South Waziristan, did not look like candidates. Baitullah Mesud, a plump, black-bearded radical in his early 30s, had organized an armed force of several thousand militia fighters. He gave interviews threatening revolutionary war against the Pakistani state. Among the historical rivals of the Mesuds were the Wazirs. They had been influenced by radical ideology as well, but their leaders saw less cause to act in overt hostility to Pakistan, at least for now. Musharraf adapted the British colonial strategy of playing one tribal network against the other. The Pakistani military's lines of communication to Afghanistan had long run through Wazir territory in North Waziristan. Musharraf and his corps commanders thought we should play ball with the wazirs, as Musharraf put it. When American officials protested, he told them, leave the tactical matters to us. We know our people. Musharraf's top generals backed his strategy to accommodate some militants in Waziristan. Shock and awe is fine for you if you fly in from the U.S. or Canada, Musharraf's defense secretary, retired Lieutenant General Tariq Wasim Ghazi, told the Pentagon. Shock and awe is no good for us when we have to live with the tribal areas as part and parcel of Pakistan. Ghazi increasingly found the Pentagon to be unsympathetic. In fact, U.S. commanders had concluded that American and NATO soldiers across the border in Afghanistan were dying as a result of the Pakistan Army's accommodations in Waziristan. Pentagon delegations arrived in Pakistan with fancy graphs about attacks going up in Afghanistan as a result of Musharraf's approach, but Ghazi and his colleagues found the statistics unconvincing. As more and more suicide bombers out of Waziristan attacked Pakistani government compounds and killed scores of innocent civilians in Pakistani cities, he found the American allegations that ISI was complicit with such killers irresponsible. Was it not obvious that Pakistan had lost control of these groups and was just trying to quiet them? If that's what you want to believe, believe it, Ghazi told his Pentagon counterparts. There's nothing we can do about it. Besides Dave Smith, there was perhaps a basketball team's worth of senior intelligence officers in the American system with a deep, street-level feel for Pakistan's regional diversity, national resilience, kaleidoscopic Islamist militancy, and party politics. Like Smith, most of these specialists had lived and worked in the country in an earlier era, when informal travel was easier and safer. The embassy's security protocols that kicked in after 2001 only tightened as suicide and truck bombings spread across Pakistan after 2006. That left American diplomats and spies often trapped behind the walls and razor wire of the embassy compound in Islamabad and the consulates in Peshawar, Lahore, and Karachi. In the summer of 2007, the Bush administration recruited Peter Lavoie as the new National Intelligence Officer for South Asia, the government's chief intelligence analyst for the region. In several roles over the next 8 years, Lavoie would become one of the most influential Pakistan experts at the White House. An Oval Office briefer, a supervisor of classified national intelligence estimates, the expert in the Situation Room, who stood before maps to try to succinctly describe the nuances of Pakistani ethnography or party politics. He was, in some ways, an unlikely intelligence bureaucrat. As an undergraduate, he had studied government and international relations at Crunchy Oberlin College, and then enrolled in the political science doctoral program at the University of California at Berkeley. California suited him. He was about 6 feet tall, athletic-looking, and had the manner of a surfer bartender. He took great care with the martinis he decanted at dinner parties, and he typically traveled with a humidor of cigars. He was a natural organizer and master of ceremonies, quick with a joke, difficult to rattle. As a graduate student, after a false start in Soviet studies, Lavoie took a research position in India, where he decided to write his doctoral dissertation on the Indian nuclear program. To deepen his language skills, he enrolled in the Berkeley Urdu program in Lahore, Pakistan. Spoken Urdu, the national language of Pakistan, is similar to Hindi, India's predominant national language. Between 1989 and 1990, Lavoie lived with a Pakistani family near Punjab University. He traveled widely, to the Karakoram mountain range along the border with China, the federally administered tribal areas, and the deserts of Balochistan. He developed a genuine fondness for Pakistan and encountered its diversity as few of its own citizens have a chance to do. After graduate school, he worked in Lawrence Livermore Laboratory's C Division, the nuclear lab's center for proliferation analysis. Then he won appointment to the faculty of the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, the fog-shrouded beach town to the north of Carmel and Big Sur. At Monterey, Lavoie became well known in South Asia scholarship and policy networks for the conferences he hosted, which brought together Pakistani and Indian military officers, journalists, and civilian government officials. The events usually climaxed with a beach bonfire and barbecue, where Lavoie presided as the Indian and Pakistani visitors talked over the pounding surf, in an atmosphere as far from enmity as it was possible for Americans to create. During the Clinton administration's second term, Lavoie joined the Pentagon's Counter-Proliferation Office, whose missions included the containment of Pakistan's nuclear program. In 2007, when the Bush administration searched for a new national intelligence officer to help the cabinet make sense of Pakistan's worsening implosion, it turned to Lavoie, and he took up his position on the CIA's campus that summer. Once inside the government's classified bubble, Lavoie could see in vivid detail what he had discerned in broad strokes from outside, namely, how badly the relationship between the United States and Pakistan was going. A recent national intelligence estimate about terrorism had described Pakistan as a safe haven for al-Qaeda. It was a phrase that, to Musharraf at least, suggested that the Americans now believed Pakistan was complicit with the authors of September 11th. Hideouts would be a better description, Musharraf complained privately. Trust had eroded to the bone. At the White House, the main question debated by Bush's advisors was, how can we navigate this increasingly impure relationship with Pakistan to pursue our urgent objectives against al-Qaeda? As he began sitting in on national security meetings presided over by Bush, or more often, National Security Advisor Stephen Hadley, Lavoie felt duty-bound to brief the material provided by the intelligence bureaucracy. But he could tell how frustrated cabinet members and deputies were with a lot of these prepackaged briefs and PowerPoints. They seemed loaded with a lot of information, but did not provide a lot of insight. Hardly anyone among the secretaries or deputy secretaries managing policy had long, direct experience on the ground in Pakistan. They might have gotten to know their counterparts in the Pakistan Army or the Foreign Ministry and formed a few impressions from these relationships and from reading. Yet their responsibilities at state, the Pentagon, or the CIA spanned the world, and it was impossible for most of them to untangle complexities within complexities involving the wazirs, the Massouds, or the structure of the Afghan Taliban's revival. Principals and deputies in Washington tended to reach a judgment, ISI is the problem, for example, because of the operations of Directorate S, and then never changed their minds. It wasn't as if such a judgment lacked a factual basis. The problem was that it did not account for what had become, in 2007, a very dynamic situation. The birth of a serious, violent, domestic rebellion against the Pakistani state, carried out by some of the Islamist forces the state had long nurtured. On Directorate S and the revival of the Afghan Taliban, during 2007 and 2008, American and NATO intelligence did become clearer, informed by harder evidence. It showed that Musharraf and Kayani had authorized deniable support to the movement, stopping short of weapons supply. The reporting showed that they were very cautious about directly providing money and weapons to the Taliban, because they feared they could get caught and pay a price in the international system. Retired ISI officers, non-governmental organizations, and other cutouts supplied the Taliban to reduce this risk. American intelligence reporting on individual serving ISI case officers who managed contacts with the Quetta Shura or the Haqqanis or Lashkar-e-Taiba, which fought in Kashmir, also showed that they were clearly in the Pakistan Army's chain of command. This reporting belied any rogue ISI hypothesis. Overall, it was very difficult to reach a judgment that Pakistan did this or that, or even that there was such a thing as Pakistan's policy, when there were so many actors, and when Directorate S was engaging diverse militant groups for different purposes at different times. In the tribal areas, ISI sometimes made deals with violent radicals for defensive, tactical reasons, to forestall attacks on themselves, or to get military supplies through to isolated bases. Other times, the ISI made deals for strategic reasons, to encourage the groups to enlarge their influence inside Afghanistan, or to attack Indian targets there. Still other times, the army attacked these same groups in retaliation for attacks inside Pakistan. Each major American intelligence agency had its own reporting stream about ISI and Directorate S, and each had its own emphasis. At the CIA, the most sophisticated analytical products about ISI were distributed by the Near East and South Asia office of the Directorate of Intelligence, a warren of offices and pods in the new headquarters building at Langley. Some of the Afghan and Pakistan specialists there had moved to CIA from intelligence positions in the military, while others had graduate degrees in political science or international relations. In considering ISI's relationship with the Haqqanis or the Afghan Taliban, the CIA group would ask whether Directorate S or its contractors had cognizance, influence, or control of a particular guerrilla or terrorist unit, a sliding scale of culpability. Clearly, ISI influenced the Haqqanis and the Quetta Shura, but to say the service controlled these organizations was doubtful, according to this analysis. In Waziristan, the Pakistan army was clearly weaker than the militants. The CIA's analysts also tried to convey the limits of ISI's competence. From experience tracing to the 1980s, agency operators and former chiefs of station knew that while some IS officers were highly professional and capable, others were venal, corrupt, and passive. In Washington, it was increasingly common for policymakers and members of Congress to talk of ISI as an omnipotent, malign, highly effective force, when in fact, the rise of domestic terrorism in Pakistan could be just as well understood as profound evidence of ISI's incompetence. Overall, the United States began to collect massive amounts of evidence that Musharraf and Kayani were directing the Taliban's revival. But the Americans did not want to reveal this information because it would expose sources and methods that they wanted to continue to exploit. At the same time, the intelligence showed that at the lower levels of ISI, in the field, officers pursued their own plans without necessarily informing the Army brass in advance of every operation. In the Situation Room, Lavoy learned, the best that might be realistically hoped for from overwhelmed decision-makers, up to and including the President, was a willingness to avoid cartoonish, stubborn, black-and-white judgments and to accept, "It's complicated." I do not believe that any true Muslim will make an attack on me because Islam forbids attacks on women, and Muslims know that if they attack a woman, they will burn in hell, Benazir Bhutto told the journalists who had assembled in Dubai to accompany her on an Emirates Airlines flight to Karachi to return at last from political exile. Secondly, Islam forbids suicide bombing. She boarded on the morning of October 18, 2007. Party workers in custom-made Benazir T-shirts chanted slogans as the jet reached cruising altitude, defying the pleadings of stewardesses in red pillbox hats to remain seated with their seatbelts fastened. Bhutto agreed to a press scrum mid-flight. "I am not scared," she said. "I am thinking of my mission. This is a movement for democracy, because we are under threat from extremists and militants." Her plane skidded onto the tarmac at Karachi and taxied to a VIP terminal. The journalists descended first, to be in position to record her descent onto Pakistani asphalt. She had been away from Pakistan for almost a decade. Wearing a white headscarf and clutching prayer beads, she tilted her head to the sky operatically, summoned tears, and declared, "It's great to be back home. It's a dream come true." The stronghold of Bhutto's Pakistan People's Party lies in rural Sindh province, near Karachi. The party includes an undemocratic patronage machine that can mobilize large turnouts on order. At least 1 million loyalists packed the streets around the airport that afternoon. They waved red, black, and green PPP flags, wore red, black, and green PPP baseball hats, blew noisemakers, and pounded drums. By nightfall, the procession had advanced only a few hundred yards through the crowds toward the tomb of Muhammad Ali Jinnah, Pakistan's founder, where Bhutto planned to speak to a rally. She rode in a tall truck with a custom plexiglass crow's nest on top, from which she could wave and orate through loudspeakers. Near midnight, two bombs, a smaller one, then one much larger, ripped through the throngs around her. They killed 139 people and wounded another 400, but left Bhutto unhurt. Her aides whisked her away from her truck as her parade descended into mayhem. Body parts strewn about, ambulances pushing through the crowds, and rescue workers treating the wounded or carrying them away on stretchers. At Bhutto's truck, party workers lifted reporters up a ladder into the crow's nest to examine the crime scene firsthand. She had left behind speech notes. A few days later, at her Karachi home, Bhutto said she remained determined to campaign for office. Few targets of political murder attempts have contemplated the possibility of their demise in advance as thoroughly as she had. She had returned after half reconciling with Musharraf, but did not know whether she trusted him. "You know, what is trust?" she asked. "You can't see into people's hearts. I don't know him, so I can't say." The intelligence service of the United Arab Emirates, perhaps informed by intelligence relayed from Britain or the United States, had warned Bhutto before she flew to Karachi that suicide bombing squads had been dispatched from Waziristan to attack her. Because of her family's long history of intense, even fatal conflict with ISI and the army, Bhutto was inclined to see the threat as rooted in Pakistan's deep state, not merely attributable to martyrdom-seeking independent radicals from the tribal areas. 2 days before she flew to Karachi, Bhutto had written to Musharraf. She named at least one former and two serving Pakistani officials as likely suspects if there was an attempt on her life. One of the names on her list was Lieutenant General Hamid Gul, who had been Director General of ISI during her first term as Prime Minister until she dismissed him from the post. The second was Brigadier Ijaz Shah, the Director General of the Intelligence Bureau, the country's equivalent of the FBI. The third was Chaudhry Pervez Elahi, a civilian politician allied with Musharraf, and then the Chief Minister of Punjab. Bhutto felt these three would go to any length to stop me, as she put it. Yet she did not appear to possess, or at least she did not cite, specific evidence that any of them might be involved in a conspiracy to kill her. Bhutto interpreted the bombing of her convoy in Karachi as confirmation that parts of the government were involved, at least on the periphery, in active plots to kill her. Her thinking was not irrational. The police teams sent to protect her homecoming were inadequate, and in the area where the attack occurred, the streetlights had been turned off. Perhaps owing to one of the city's chronic power failures, but perhaps not. Ann Patterson, the American ambassador, flew to Karachi. Bhutto presented a written request to meet with U.S. embassy experts to evaluate her security. That night, Patterson cabled Washington urging that the Bush administration refuse her because an audit will inevitably expose performance gaps in Bhutto's arrangements that would not meet American standards of training and equipment. Responsibility for security belongs with the government of Pakistan. This was a global policy, with only the rarest of exceptions, as with Karzai when he was first installed. The United States could not get into the business of managing security for office holders and opposition leaders in foreign countries. Yet Bhutto insisted that Musharraf's protection was inadequate. Patterson urged that while the embassy might refer Bhutto to qualified Pakistani security contractors who could evaluate her security, the embassy should not help directly. The Bush administration should either undertake full responsibility for Bhutto's personal security, a non-starter in nationalist Pakistan during an election campaign, or not. In early November, Musharraf imposed a state of emergency in what would prove to be his final effort to hold on to power. Even then, Bhutto never broke with him entirely, and when Musharraf eventually confirmed that elections would go forward in January, Bhutto decided that the People's Party would compete. Later that month, Musharraf at last resigned as chief of the army staff to stand for re-election as president as a civilian. He elevated Ashfaq Kayani as his successor in command of the military, handing over to him the most powerful office in Pakistan. At ISI, Musharraf simultaneously installed a man with family and personal loyalties to him, General Nadeem Taj. Once Bhutto committed herself to the election, the question of her personal security took on renewed significance. Her competitors on election day would be Musharraf's political followers, and they controlled the local governments and police forces whose services Bhutto required for her safety. Yet increasingly, amid the swirl of events, Bhutto and Musharraf no longer saw themselves as potential allies. Bhutto moved instead toward a political détente with Nawaz Sharif, the leader of the center-right Muslim League, who had also returned from exile to compete in the election. Bhutto decided to hold a rally at Liaquat Bagh, a park in Rawalpindi. When the day arrived, December 27th, Nadeem Taj visited her in the early hours, just after midnight. They talked for 2 hours about the campaigning, as well as about threats on Bhutto's life. A few days earlier, the Pakistani Interior Ministry had received a report that Osama bin Laden had ordered the assassination of Bhutto, Musharraf, and a third Pakistani politician. Taj warned Bhutto to take precautions. Hamid Karzai happened to be visiting Islamabad. After the ISI meeting, Bhutto drove to see him in his fourth-floor suite at the Serena Hotel. She admired his cape, and they laughed as he recounted how he had acquired it, an improbable tale that involved a visit to the exiled king of Afghanistan. They sipped tea and coffee and discussed the region's gathering political violence. Militant Islamic leaders had by now named both of them as targets for assassinations. "I am not afraid of death," Bhutto told Karzai. At the rally, Bhutto sat on the platform and listened to the opening speeches. Her aides' cell phones began to ring. Sherry Rahman, a senior political and media advisor, leaned over to relay some news. Elsewhere in the city, gunmen had killed some of Nawaz Sharif's election workers. "Okay," Bhutto said. "We must phone him to offer sympathy and support." She asked Rahman to remind her to make the call. She was hoarse from campaigning but delivered a rousing speech. "Long live Bhutto," the crowd chanted, as she descended from the platform at around 5 p.m. She got into a white Toyota Land Cruiser with a sunroof. As the vehicle left the park, the driver crossed the median to turn east. Another crowd of chanting supporters swarmed toward her. The vehicle stopped. Bhutto's aides unrolled the sunroof and stood up to wave to them. A clean-shaven man wearing sunglasses and a black vest moved toward her, raised a pistol, and fired 3 times. Then he tucked down his head and detonated a suicide vest filled with ball bearings. Bhutto died instantly. The blast killed 24 others. Bhutto's aides released to the press the various warnings she had written down, to be publicized in the event of her death. On January 3rd, Musharraf held a press conference in Islamabad to defend himself against Bhutto's accusatory ghost. His government announced it had obtained phone intercepts indicating that Baitullah Masood, emir of the newly declared Pakistani Taliban movement, had organized Bhutto's assassination. Musharraf wore a suit and tie and sat at a table by himself. "I have been brought up in a very educated and civilized family, which believes in values, which believes in principles, which believes in character," he said. "My family is not a family that believes in killing people." Musharraf said Bhutto had ignored warnings that campaign rallies had become too dangerous, and he blamed her for standing recklessly in the open air to greet her supporters. As for Bhutto's suspicions that Pakistan's deep state might have been involved, Musharraf dismissed such thinking as a joke. With apparent sincerity, he added, "No intelligence organization of Pakistan is capable of indoctrinating a man to blow himself up." In February, the People's Party swept to power, and Asif Zardari, Bhutto's erratic widower, became Pakistan's president, At the time, perhaps the world's most unlikely leader of a nuclear-armed nation outside of North Korea. He told Patterson that the United States was Pakistan's safety blanket, and assured her that he believed there was no such thing as a moderate Taliban. He added, "I am not Benazir, and I know it." Although it was not yet obvious to everyone in the Bush administration, Musharraf was finished politically. He would cling to the office of president for a few more months before resigning. He later went into exile. The twin pillars of the Bush administration's reformed policy in Pakistan, Musharraf and Bhutto, were gone. Chapter 17. Hard Data. Toward the end of 2007, a team of career CIA analysts at the Directorate of Intelligence, who specialized in assessing wars, carried a set of highly classified, color-coded maps of Afghanistan to the White House to unfurl them for decision-makers at the National Security Council. The map project was called the District Assessments. It attempted to describe political control and security in each of Afghanistan's 398 official administrative districts. The CIA unit collected and aggregated about 36 independent indicators for each district. Some of the data could be objectively counted. The number of roadside bombings or assassinations during the last 6 months, for example. Other judgments, such as the extent of Taliban influence on a rural population, might require more qualitative measurement. But these assessments could still be informed by data such as whether the Taliban operated checkpoints on the roads or were reliably reported to run informal courts in local mosques. After all the intelligence was organized, the CIA team gave each Afghan administrative district one of four ratings. The rating spectrum ranged from districts controlled by the Karzai government to districts controlled or contested by the Taliban. There was also a category, and a distinct color on the map, for districts judged to be under local control, meaning that they were run by independent warlords or drug barons not aligned with either side, or were controlled by nobody at all, essentially ungoverned. In the closed world of secret intelligence, most analytical products wound up in locked cabinets, having had little impact. But every now and then, a bestseller broke through. The CIA's district assessment maps of Afghanistan proved to be such a blockbuster, one of the most popular top-secret analytical products the agency had ever distributed. Tony Scannella, a courteous academic with a black mustache, would soon rotate in to supervise the project. He would work on it for almost a decade, becoming one of the most influential analysts of the Afghan war in the government. Scannella had analyzed the Balkan conflicts of the 1990s, and then, after September 11th, the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. He had earned a doctoral degree at the Center for International Studies at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Political scientists at MIT had advanced the use of data and mathematical modeling in search of insights into war and peace. The Afghan maps Scannella and his colleagues created followed this methodology. The impetus for the map's initial creation was a new focus on the Afghan war within the Bush administration, following the late 2006 strategic review carried out at the White House. In mid-2007, Bush and his national security advisor, Stephen Hadley, had recruited Major General Douglas Lute to the White House in an effort to coordinate support for the dual American war efforts in Iraq and Afghanistan. In time, Lute would become Washington's most important policy advisor on Afghanistan. But in his early days at the White House, he spent at least 90% of his time managing the fiasco in Iraq. Lute was among those at the White House who were enthusiastic about the District Assessments project. Rare is the general who does not love a map, and with the distractions of Iraq, here was a concise way to track progress, or the lack of it, in Afghanistan. Intelligence consumers in diverse agencies seemed to appreciate the CIA map's mesmerizing colors unfurled in cascades of red and green. In the emerging era of big data, the CIA maps were an exemplar of the power of data visualization. They also provided a way to capture changes in the war's progress empirically. American military commanders in Afghanistan often rotated annually, and ambassadors moved on every 2 or 3 years.